Greetings, troubled listeners. Welcome back to the Troubled Men Podcast. I'm Renee Coleman, sitting once again in Snake and Jake's Christmas Club Lounge in the heart of the Clempire with my co-host, the original troubled man for troubled times and future mayor of New Orleans, Mr. Manny Chevrolet. Welcome, Manny.
Hey, man. Hey. Is going on with you?
Oh, you know, it's glad to be out here. It's the night before, what is that, Halloween?
Yes, Halloween.
And it's the start of the new school year, I guess, or been in for a little bit, but we
the
got carded.
Started in August.
Okay, well,
we start the new year.
Time
new
flies.
School.
New school year recently. But we got carded here.
Yes, into we got carded because the tobacco, what are the...
ATF.
ATF came are coming down on these uptown places, apparently.
Yeah.
And I got carded, which is always fun.
Yeah. You know,
I like getting carded at the supermarket.
The grocery store, yeah.
I get carded every once in a while at the grocery store, and I say thank you.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I say thank you. Thank you for carding me. You know, but yeah, I guess some places got busted or whatever,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, some of those more...
Well, because we're like right off the college, the big college campus.
Right, right. You got a lot of kids around here.
Yeah.
And so some of those more exclusively college-age bars over there on Maple Street, I think they got busted.
Yeah, there's some on Maples and there's some on Broadway. And,
uh-huh.
Yeah, they're all over the place. And put them all in jail.
Yeah.
You know, put them
all. Well, I was wondering if this is a new initiative from our mayor, our governor, Jeff Landry, if this is part of his.
I don't know. I mean, it could be. Because I know he's sending more and more state people down here.
Right. They have Troop NOLA, a whole dedicated troop for New Orleans.
And, you know, it is the Halloween weekend in this city. You know, of course, you know, any excuse to dress up in gay outfits and stuff like that.
Sure.
You know,
gay apparel.
Yeah, the gay apparel and stuff. And, you know, but I don't... Halloween was weird in my neighborhood because, like, 2 years ago, we ran out of candy. Last year, we didn't give out any candy. And so I don't know what to expect
this
year.
How's it trending? Can you see?
So I'm just giving out ice cubes.
Okay.
I'm just going to give out ice cubes. I didn't want to buy any candy.
Right.
Because I can't predict if we're going to have trick-or-treaters or
right.
not.
Well, ice cubes, you know, it's a healthy snack.
Yeah.
It's not going to rot your teeth out.
And I remember I also, a few years back, I gave out advice. You know, I said, trick-or-treat. And I said, all right, kid, how old are you? You know, and they'd say, I'm 7 years old. I said, don't go into porn. Whatever you do, don't go into pornography.
That's solid advice.
Yeah, that's solid advice. Don't work the pole, young lady. You know, that's the advice I gave my daughter.
Don't take money from a woman. Yeah, don't start messing around with dope.
Yeah, don't do any of that.
Right.
You know, go to school. You know, stay in school. That kind of stuff.
Right.
But so Halloween's weird and stuff like that. I've never been a big Halloween fan.
Yeah, you're
even
not.
Even though I did it as a kid and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, but you're not someone who would wear a costume now.
No,
me either.
I would never. I did it as a kid, and that's about it, you know. But
sure.
It's scary, you know. But in my neighborhood, the neighborhood association puts on a big party for the kids.
Huh.
Over in that little park on Esplanade. I forget what it's called, that park.
Right, right.
They put on a party for the kids, so it makes it safe.
Okay.
And stuff like that. There are no razor blades and apples and stuff like that. Or no one's getting dosed and stuff.
No candy-colored fentanyl.
Yeah.
You know, keeps that to a minimum.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So, you know, but if we're going to fight the war on terror, I do believe we should start with haunted houses.
Okay. Because they're terrifying.
Yeah, they're terrifying, you know. I really think we should do that.
Yeah, I don't like those kind of jump scares either, you know, like somebody jumps out and goes, ah.
Yeah.
What's fun about that?
Yeah, I don't like that at all. I mean, I went to that stuff when I was a younger guy. But, in fact, you know, back in Los Angeles, Knott's Berry Farm, which is right across the street from Disneyland out in Anaheim, they would have, their Halloween was a big thing there. Disneyland didn't do much for Halloween, but Knott's Berry Farm had these haunted houses and stuff like that. And I went there with an ex-girlfriend and her sister got felt up and stuff.
Huh.
By these people that just jump out of nowhere and stuff like that.
Really?
Yeah, they jumped out of nowhere. Well, they grabbed her.
That's no good.
Yeah, and she was very affected by it and stuff. So I think she tried to sue and stuff, but, you know, what are you going to do? I don't know.
It's hard to prove that kind of thing.
I broke up with that girlfriend, you know, so it wasn't my problem anymore.
Water under the bridge.
Yeah.
For you.
But, yeah, so Halloween, you know, who cares? I don't really, you know.
Sure, sure. You know. Well, we had some sad news this week, Manny.
Uh-oh,
a good friend of ours, guy who's a big fan of yours, a supporter of the podcast, never got him on, but Eric Paulson passed away.
Oh, yeah, I know, yeah. He died. That was fast, too.
Yeah, man, it was, yeah. He was.
So I don't know what kind of cancer he had.
I'm not sure.
For people who don't know him, he is a local newscaster here for the CBS affiliate down here in New Orleans, WWL-TV. And Eric was a mainstay on the morning show for years, and I used to go on that show and I'd fuck around with him and stuff like
that. Yeah, and he had a good sense of humor.
Yeah,
he liked to bat it back and forth
with
you.
Yeah, he was a good guy, and I'm sorry. I didn't know that. I didn't even know he was that old. I thought he was a lot younger than 70, whatever.
He had kind of a youthful visage, you know. He had the twinkle in his eye still. He had his hair still looked nice. And, you know, he kept himself in good shape, had a boyish face.
I knew, though,
face.
For a fact he couldn't stand that co-host for years. Huh. The one who sang happy birthday to people, what was her name? Hoda Kotb's sister or whatever.
Huh.
I don't know.
Okay.
I can't remember. But he's a good guy. He'll be missed.
I mean, he goes all the way back to, the 70s, you know? Like they had this PM magazine that I didn't remember seeing this segment, but he did a whole thing where he did a feature on Jude Akers way back then.
Oh.
And Jude was still only in his 30s or something.
Oh.
And he actually played Jude
in a series of
matches, and he held his own and even beat Jude at least once.
And now that the question, now we know more about Jude's personality. He got beat, right?
Well, I mean, yeah, he Jude would, I'm sure, have something to say about it, but yeah, Eric could hold his own with the best of them.
Yeah, he'll be missed. It's too bad we couldn't get him on the show.
Yeah, I know.
Maybe we could still get him on.
Well, maybe have a seance of some type.
So,
well, you know, somebody else we lost just yesterday.
Who's that?
Terry Garr.
Oh, yeah. The great female actress, comedian.
Yes.
Yes. I did not know this. I just found this out today that she was, she dated Dennis Hopper.
Okay.
Way back in the 60s.
Well, I saw a photograph of her sitting on a countertop that was taken by Dennis Hopper.
Dennis was a photographer, and he liked to film young ladies, you know, take pictures of them. But I don't know how tight they were or how long it lasted. But, yeah, she'll be missed. I just remember she was in Young Frankenstein and Tootsie and stuff and Mr. Mom. Which was one of my favorite movies ever made.
Huh, really?
Mr. Mom,
okay.
Yeah. I love that movie.
Wow.
And
wouldn't have guessed that.
Yeah, you got it. Martin Mull's excellent in Mr. Mom.
Okay.
You got to check it out. Trouble Nation, go watch Mr. Mom with Michael Keaton and Terry Garr. And Martin Mull, the great Martin Mull, who's also gone.
Yes, yeah.
You know.
Dropping like flies.
Yeah.
Man.
But you know what was a big thing that happened, and I want to talk about it, is Taylor Swift was here over the weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. I could not believe the amount of buildup for this chick who came here for 3 days. I mean, it was crazy going nuts.
And they had the fans all over the city dressed in
everywhere.
Their versions of her costumes.
And there was some Airbnb. You know, I have this Airbnb across the street from me, and there was Swifties staying there. So I actually went down near the Superdome over the weekend to just get a feel of it, you know? And
some immersive
just
experience.
To check it out. And you know, there's Swifties are like their age range is 5 to 75,
right?
You know?
Yeah, the cab driver was talking about that on the way from
the first thing I realized is that there are some Swifties out there that, you know, because everyone's trying to dress like Taylor Swift, and there's just some women out there who tried it and they failed miserably. They felt
yeah, those kind of legless outfits don't really flatter like every
you know, you're 75 years old. Don't do it.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
You know, you're better than that. Please don't do that.
Yeah, you don't need to keep going being sleeveless past 45.
Yeah, and it was kind of... But I got to talk to a lot of these Swifties out there, and I went through the quarter all the way to the dome, and I talked to a lot of them, all ages and stuff.
Wow.
And it was funny because I talked to, like, all of them, like, you know, the older ones, the younger ones, and 9 out of 10 Swifties all said that they'll do anal.
Wow.
You know, which I found, I said, cool.
Surprising.
Yeah, I was like, all right.
It's rather forthcoming.
Now, I don't know if she does anal, but all her followers do anal.
Jeez.
It was amazing. 9 out of 10.
And really? You just asking
say,
people,
I said,
okay.
Do you do anal? They said, oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the funny thing is, I can't even. I think there's only one song I know of hers. I don't know any of her music.
Yeah, that's most of the people our age don't know.
I
any
don't
of her
know
music.
Any of her music. And hey, so anal's good, you know.
Oh,
anal,
okay.
It's all right with me.
I didn't see that coming.
Yeah, but also, you know, like any big event that happens down here, like the Super Bowl, which we're having this coming season.
Right.
The Super Bowl. Any big event, Jazz Fest, Mardi Gras, always brings like thousands of hookers to
sure,
the city.
Sure.
Now, I was thinking, well, are hookers coming down here for the Eras tour? You know, are there male hookers coming down here? Because pretty much her whole audience is female.
Yeah.
Except for like 5%, you know, fags. You know, so... So were there male escorts coming down here to please those 75-year-old Swifties?
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't.
Because there's always hookers here for the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Tons of hookers here.
Right.
You know. So, yeah, it was an amazing event. I didn't see the show, but I was impressed by, you know, the whole thing about it and the whores, drawing thousands of whores here, male whores. But what I didn't understand, which was weird, because... the opening act for Taylor Swift was Artifacts from Auschwitz. They just showed them on the stage, which was very dark, if you ask me.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think the Swifties understood it. I don't know. I don't even know if they were there watching the Artifacts of Auschwitz.
You know, I mean, like, programming is so important in show business.
Right.
You know?
I mean, you would think they would have some, you know, pop band like Hanson.
Something light. Yeah.
You know, something like that. But apparently...
It's a hard act to follow.
Yeah.
I guess maybe she just wanted to set the bar high for herself.
I guess I'm so
good. I'm such a great entertainer. I can follow anything.
I can follow... Yeah, exactly. So...
holy cow.
Yeah. Now,
I would have told her not to do that.
Yeah,
you know, she didn't ask me.
But yeah, it was weird that was the opening act.
It is a weird, very dark opening act.
Yeah. I guess it's. But anyway, that's all done with, and now we're just 1 week away from disaster.
Yeah,
basically, this is what we're dealing with right now.
Right. I actually went and voted early.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So this show will come out after the election. Now it'll come out 2 days after we vote.
Oh.
Now, I don't know if we will actually have a result by that time.
Who knows? I don't know. I really don't know. But I know early voters were getting threatened.
Hmm.
You know, like in
what
fact,
way?
Today in Florida, of course it's Florida, there was some young guy who was trying to stop people from voting by wielding a machete at them. Did you hear about this?
No.
Voting is risky, you know. I guess it's probably the safest thing to do is absentee vote.
It was pretty calm over in at Lake Vista, but, you know.
Okay. Well, some guy was wheeling a machete at Florida voters and trying to keep them away. But, yeah, that's pretty much, it's crazy going nuts, man.
Okay, so now you have your voting plans, Manny? You know where you vote?
I know where I go, yeah.
But you didn't early vote, though.
No. I'm too busy for that.
Oh, okay. You like to do it that day?
Yeah, because my neighbor a few houses down is one of the people who works the voting place at the school auditorium.
Uh-huh.
And she always has donuts and coffee and candy, so I like to go when she's there.
Oh, okay. You like the kind of donuts she gets?
Yeah, she brings donuts and coffee and lots of candy. So She gives me a lot of that stuff. So
they don't give you the day off from work on election day, do they?
No, I didn't think so. I don't know, because the polls don't close to what 8 o'clock or something.
Right.
That.
Some countries they have that national holiday.
And where are those countries now? I don't know.
I don't know. They're somewhere.
But yeah, it's going to be interesting. It's going to be very interesting.
Well, yeah, I just would like to see him gone so that he doesn't, because just this run up to the election has been exhausting, the day to day with all that stuff, and one thing I liked about the past administration is you'd hear about them from time to time, and mostly just kind of receded into the background, which is really what you want the government to do.
Well, they say he's exhausted, and so it's too much to ask that he'll collapse, But
he's having too good a time. I just keep thinking, missed him by that much. That's the one thing I keep thinking about. But getting back to this city where we live, I just found out today with our mayor. LaToya, this city is so fucking stupid, man. So, I don't know, there's been a neighborhood out in the east or somewhere that's, they built like 90 houses on this toxic land.
Did you hear
about this?
Yeah. It's been going on for some time. It's like Gordon Plaza or something.
Yeah,
and
they built these 90 houses years ago on land that was toxic.
Right.
And so finally, the city got the smarts and the money to get these people, move them to other neighborhoods, and destroy all these houses.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is great, which is fabulous. But I was looking at the news today. So, what their plan is now, after they get rid of all these houses on this toxic land, is to build solar gardens. They're going to grow vegetables and fruits on this toxic land.
Are you shitting me?
No, I'm not shitting you. I saw my wife and I were watching it just like an hour ago. They're going to build gardens, solar gardens, they call
solar,
them.
What is it? They're going to put solar panels there?
I don't know what solar garden means.
But,
so it's toxic land. Are you going to eat a carrot from that ground?
Chernobyl.
Are you going to do it? It's like this city. How stupid is that?
Maybe they're just using that word loosely. Hopefully they don't plan on actually harvesting food from there.
Anyway, it's crazy going.
But
nuts.
It wouldn't put it past me.
What's that neighborhood called again?
I think it's Gordon Plaza.
Now, where is that? In the east or
somewhere
something?
In New Orleans east. Yeah, I'm not exactly sure.
Well, they should succeed from this city, I think. New Orleans. Yeah, they should from Orleans.
Well, the mayor is as much trouble as she's in with all these investigations that she has.
Yeah.
She's still not done. So I saw she was in the newspaper just the other day, and then the tail end of that story showed up on the news tonight, where there was a whole bunch of police officers that were supposed to be promoted.
Right, and she stopped it. Yeah.
And initially, the chief of police said, "Well, we're going to stop this. I'm not going to promote from this list."
Emo Phillips.
Fitzpatrick, I think, or Kirkpatrick or something. Said, "So we're going to reevaluate this." And then some reporter said, "Well, did the mayor?" Because two of these people that were supposed to be promoted at the highest levels
testified against
Captain
Vappy.
We're doing the investigation on the Officer Vappy affair and didn't cave in to pressure to put the fix in, allegedly.
Right.
And so as much as the microscope is on Mayor Cantrell, she still can't help herself, her typical vindictive nature. And so they asked the chief of police, Did the mayor step in here? Said, "Well, yeah, she actually did," because the chief of police is giving her some cover, but she's smart enough to realize that I don't want to put my tail in the crack with her. I don't want to be part of this conspiracy.
Well, we've got another year of LaToya, so we'll see what happens.
All right, she just keeps giving them more things to investigate her about. Well, maybe we should get to our guest here, huh? It's been going on for a while. All right. This is a guest I've I met many, many years ago. We've think this might be the first time we've seen each other in about 30 years. But he's a colleague of a great friend of ours. He's a terrific poet, lyricist, a longtime songwriting partner of our good buddy Chuck Prophet. He's also a freelance literary editor, former comedy writer, and autodidact. And we're going to get into all that and more. But without further ado, the great Mr. Kurt Lipschutz. Welcome, Kurt.
Thank you.
Hey, yeah. Welcome.
Hey.
So you're just in town, kind of a whirlwind visit here. You're here with your wife.
Yeah, she's here for a conference, and I'm extra luggage and having a good time being.
You're
extra
the carry-on, right?
Yeah, there you go.
Well, so the first time I met you, I think maybe you'd been working as a songwriting partner with Chuck for a couple of years, and I think Chuck, a similar kind of situation where Chuck had some tickets that he had to use before they were about to expire, and he said, well, let's go to New Orleans and just hang around, visit Renee, and he brought you along as his date.
Correct, yeah, and you took us to Rockin' Bowl, and,
right?
And we saw Snooks Eaglin.
Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, Snooks Eaglin with George Porter playing bass with him.
You can't beat that.
Yeah. I remember going down to Frenchman Street with you, and we went to Cafe Brazil, and I'm not sure if you remember all that, but I remember being in there with you, and you and I had a big conversation. Maybe I was talking about Flannery O'Connor or something. You started bring up Barry Hanna, who I was not familiar with.
One of my heroes, it's people should be, but
Well, he's very much in that Flannery O'Connor, you know, southern milieu, and you wound up sending me the book Airships. Thank you so much. I it was a book of short stories. I devoured it, and every time I go up to Oxford, Mississippi, I'll bring up Barry Hanna if there's someone who's kind of in the literary clique up there, and I always get a lot of resonance with people up there.
Yeah, with the Southern writers, I mean, he's the comedian, really.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure. I'm sure Flannery O'Connor had a sense of humor, but
she's very funny.
Yeah, killing people. You know that guy that in A Good Man Is Hard to Find. But Barry was of a different order. I mean, kind of an absurdist and played with language and just never quite hit the big time, but he was the quintessential writer's writer.
And much beloved. Well, let's go back a little bit, tell us about, so you're obviously not from New Orleans. Tell us about where you're born, where you grew up.
Well, I was born in Indio, California, and grew up in Palm Springs, California.
You're a desert rat, huh?
Yeah, I left when I was 17 and a half. I fled. And,
to where, L.A.?
No, I was, well, I...
Vegas?
Well, I was, I sort of did a Jack Kerouac.
Area 54?
Yeah, no, just kind of hitchhiking around the country and then ended up in L.A., actually, you know, so...
So Palm Springs, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Early, yeah. When there wasn't much going on there.
So what did your parents do in Palm Springs?
My dad was a doctor. And, he was from... Philadelphia. My mom was from Atlantic City, and I think her dad was a lawyer, and I don't know much about this, but I think Nucky Johnson tried to hire him, and he told Nucky Johnson to fuck off, and isn't that Broadway Empire or something like that?
Yeah. I know.
Yeah,
what you're
the Steve
about.
Buscemi. Yeah, but yeah. Anyway, but they moved the one.
So your dad was a mob doctor?
No, well he did. I did hear that he took care of somebody from the Purple Gang once. I don't know who the Purple Gang is and what he did, how he took care of him. But but he wasn't the one. Kind of a rebellious thing they did was to get away from their families on the East Coast.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah.
So,
that's not rebellious.
And they moved to
that's
the.
Smart.
But he was, of note, Elvis's doctor.
Oh, okay.
So, wow.
Yeah.
Elvis lived in Palm Springs.
This was, 1968, right before whenever the first reconquest of Vegas.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, that was the 68 comeback, right?
Well, right.
So like a lot of the Rat Pack. you know, settled in Palm Springs. Frank and Sam, they all had places there in Palm Springs.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So would you run into those guys? Or
no,
would you,
but we would when we were old enough to, there was a chain called the Old World, kind of an L.A. chain, and they had a place in Palm Springs. And when we were just old enough to drink and just didn't have anything else to do, we would go to the Old World, and it was real quiet, and we'd say, Sinatra, let me tell you something about Sinatra. And then the place would get quiet, and you know, we didn't have anything to say. He did a good friend of mine, a real good friend of mine, a guy I worked with and who died of an alcohol overdose. His uncle was slapped around by Jilly Rizzo Jerry the Crusher. Because this was Frank Weinstock. He's in the index of Kitty Kelly's book on Sinatra. Sure. Sinatra was between marriages, and the guy went to the bathroom, and they came in and said, Mr. Sinatra would like to buy a drink for the lady you're with. And it was his wife. Oh. And so he made the mistake of calling him by his last name, saying, you know, you tell Sinatra. And those were his last words.
Before. Oh, really?
Yeah. Anyway, but he sued Sinatra and won. This guy, Frank Weinstock, he sued Sinatra and won. But, you know, those 60 Minutes episodes where you have to get an execution of judgment,
right,
where you have to go to the dry cleaner or something,
yeah,
and, you know, and they don't have any money in the till and that kind of stuff. Uh-huh. They could never collect from Sinatra because a sheriff would never cooperate because Frank was a benefactor. He built all the hospitals in town and stuff like that.
Yep.
So anyway.
There's this great Sinatra Jilly story. Apparently back in the old Vegas days, Shecky Green was working one of the lounges, and he insulted some mobsters a little bit too much. And apparently, like an hour later, these guys in the audience were like, I guess on one of the floors of the hotel, and they were just beating the shit out of Shecky. They were just beating him. And Sinatra and Jilly just happened to walk by, and Frank says, I think that's enough. And he saved Jilly's life because it's Shecky's life. They would have killed him because they were beating him horribly. And Frank had just done a show or just, you know, I don't know what he did, but he was just walking by and said, I think that's enough.
He's had enough.
So he saved Shecky Green's life.
Yeah, we never did see those characters, but we saw Liberace.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just where would you see him? Cruising
no,
the bars?
Just kind of at a bar with an entourage. But he had a house right next to a compound at the north end of town, right next to the synagogue.
Okay.
And so anyway, that was, but, you know, and everybody had big hedges and stuff like that.
You guys just lived in those same kind of neighborhoods?
Well, we lived in a fairly modest place. I mean, a ranch style house. I mean, I was I was 13 and I was pretty non-materialistic, but my dad had a 65 Dodge Polara, and I was actually embarrassed because he took me up when he took me over to meet Elvis. I was kind of
in a 65 Polara.
Yeah, you know, he kind of called into question my anti-materialism, I think, you know. So.
Well, yeah, I remember I'm from Los Angeles, and I remember, like, I guess in the early 80s when like MTV exploded and stuff, and they would have these like gigs from like spring break and you know, in Florida and stuff like that. And LA really didn't have like a spring break. And then all of a sudden, like Palm Springs became spring break for campuses in SoCal. All these kids would go down to Palm Springs and stay in the cheaper motels and stuff where they had pools and just party and party. Were you ever a part of that? Do you remember anything?
No, but I remember that I remember there were some kind of heavy crackdowns on that. And the local newspaper, the Desert Sun, took a page out of the Adolf Trump playbook and had an editorial and called the kids vermin. So, yeah. But
there's also a town, I just think, a little bit north of Palm Springs where they have this very famous old opera house. Do you know where that is?
No, I don't.
Oh, okay.
Growing up in Palm Springs there, were you already interested in writing? Were you were you a poetry fan early on?
Well, my older brothers had books, and they introduced me to Bukowski.
Okay.
That was sort of that was foundational, I guess. It took me till I was, in my mid 20s to get over my condescension toward Shakespeare.
To figure
he had something going on,
Right.
But Bukowski, of course, was the quintessential L.A. guy who wrote for the L.A. Free Press.
Yeah, he wrote for the Weekly and the L.A. Pretty much the Free Press. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so that, and
see, as a young teenager, I used to buy the Free Press because they'd have these sexy kind of stories in there too, and Bukowski had his little stories and our poetry and stuff. And as a 12-13 year old, you're just like, wow,
Yeah. He had great drawings too.
Yes.
He really could draw, and they were pretty funny,
And also, do you remember David Lynch did that little cartoon for the LA Weekly?
Yeah.
The Angriest Dog.
Yeah.
And that was just three panels of cartoon drawings and then a few words. And it was a fucking hilarious thing. It was so hilarious.
Yeah, I liked Mulholland. I mean, that was the last thing of his I could get into.
Yeah.
The movie. Yeah.
Yeah. So
are you starting to try to write in that style?
Well, I think what I would do, I had a Smith Corona Selectric, and I would just type lines, fill up. Fill up pages, and I really don't know. I mean, but I don't know what, my oldest brother wrote poetry more in a kind of a visionary kind of context, like the French poet Rimbaud or something like that. So I was it was in the air too.
Yeah,
I mean, I was,
What year was this?
This would have been
early
70s. Yeah, early 70s or something like that. Right after I met Elvis.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you feel like meeting Elvis had any sort of impact on your destiny? Did you get a sense of your own the possibilities in life after meeting?
Well, I've written a long poem about it, and probably the story's as good as the poem. I don't know if it, or the poem's as bad as the story. But I was 13. I had kind of a mysterious condition. I couldn't walk, and. One of my legs just kind of came out, and I went to not an osteopath, but whatever they call the bone doctors. And I remember my dad. You guys know, remember Catherine Kuhlman, the evangelist. My dad was an MD, and I remember my dad. It was a little, it was whatever, a strange character.
She used to say, "I believe in miracles."
Right.
She used to say that.
Well, and my dad didn't believe in miracles, but he did yell at me. Walk, 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 and it didn't work. And then I went, and I went to the specialist, and they put me on crutches, and for a month, and
this happened out of nowhere,
they thought it was a disease. It's a disease called Perthes, some kind of a degeneration of the hip or something.
But you were fine up until.
I was fine, but I was not looking forward to going back to school with. With crutches. I already had a lazy eye and braces. I mean, who needs it, right?
You were a mess.
Yeah. I mean, I went, my parents sent me to school when I was six with a fucking briefcase. I mean, they might as well just put me in a locker themselves,
But this happened before or after you met Elvis?
Well, no. Well, when I met Elvis, I was on crutches, and so the reason I met him is my dad,
because it was a Make-A-Wish Foundation day.
Yeah, well, my dad had something to offer me, right? Like, you want to meet Elvis? And I said, no, I don't want to. You know, who wants to meet Elvis? You know,
let me know
when you're taking care of Dylan. That was my kind of response.
Yeah. Okay, so you're already into Dylan at that time?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, most definitely.
So you're into music as a young kid.
But anyway, I went over and Elvis, what my dad would do, the Memphis Mafia was there.
Yeah.
Elvis was looking real good. And my dad gave them B-12 shots, which my dad didn't believe in. But they all lined up and they got B-12 shots.
Okay.
And my dad didn't really like to talk out of school, but he did tell us that Elvis watched Top Cat.
Yeah.
So, So that was,
Sonny Von Bülow got a lot of B-12 shots too.
Okay. Yeah. But Elvis, anyway, where I'm going with this is that Elvis shook my hand, and then a week later, I went back to the doctor and I could walk again.
Wow.
Okay. The facts speak for themselves.
Right. So Catherine Coleman was right.
Huh? Yeah, yeah.
I believe in you. Catherine Coleman was this evangelist back in SoCal. Okay. I don't know how far she went.
I think I've seen films, but go ahead.
But she looked like an... She wore these fucking huge dresses, these big
like white dresses,
white and light blue or powder blue, whatever. But she looked kind of like if Linda Blair in The Exorcist.
Did she? I kind of remember, maybe remember her wrong, like Piper Laurie and Carrie.
Like, yes, exactly. Yeah. She looked exactly like Piper Laurie, and she'd sit there in front of the TV and just talk to you. And, we have 5 channels back then.
Right. So sometimes you would watch that.
Watch it. It's just like, I believe in miracles. And that, that number to donate to her and stuff.
Right.
It was always there. And everyone in the house, in my house, started imitating her.
Yeah.
My mom, my dad, we all just all started imitating her. If something happened, my dad passed a test or whatever, or he actually shat once, because he was always constipated. Okay. I believe in miracles.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. But yeah, we should get her on the show.
We should reach out to her. Her people there.
Yeah.
Well, so you're 13 now. You can walk again. You've been healed by Elvis. He laid on the laying on of hands. You're already a music fan.
Back when what do they say that you could own every album that you wanted at the time, right? There were only like 200.
Okay.
And,
right. Sure.
This was before slicing and dicing everything. Rock and roll was everything.
Right.
I mean, there were some. There were some obscure groups I was into. You guys ever heard of Pearls Before Swine?
I've heard of that the band. I can't remember.
Well, anyway,
them,
kind of an odd character, a poet named Tom Rapp in Philadelphia.
Okay.
But back then, I think their first album might have sold 500,000 copies without touring. Kind of like the band's first record, I think. I don't think they toured. But anyway, there was some obscure stuff. But I mean, basically for me, being of a older generation a bit, just by a few years, but then you and Chuck, it was kind of the Buffalo Springfield, the Jefferson Airplane, Country Joe and the Fish,
right.
Dylan, Stones, Jimi Hendrix.
Sure.
That's kind of all
classics.
I needed, really.
Yeah.
I think I'm leaving somebody out. The first...
The Doors, where you went to Jim Morrison.
Oh, yeah. And the first show I saw live was Canned Heat.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That's a great band. I have a friend who plays in Canned Heat now.
Oh, okay.
In the current Canned Heat band.
You had him on the show.
Yeah. Dale Spaulding, terrific... harmonica player, singer, band leader. Yeah, he's fronting the band these days. So you said at 17 and a half you escape. Now, how do you escape? Where do you go to? Did you go to college?
I went to junior college and kind of dropped out.
Okay.
I mean, my family was very big on education, and my older brothers were National Merit Scholars.
Right.
But everything was kind of falling apart by that time, because my oldest brother had gone up to Oregon to Reed College. I don't know if you're familiar with Reed College. It, you know, kind of an eccentric place. Some of the Beats went there. And he became an acid casualty.
Oh, man.
And was in a mental hospital and then became a Jesus freak. So my parents were just kind of... They'd
given up.
Thrown
in
they
the
might
towel.
Not have known it or whatever. Yeah, you know, but they... But, yeah, and so I just left, and I with a buddy, I moved to L.A. to do stand-up comedy, or to write stand-up comedy.
Okay.
I mean, I've always been kind of the offstage guy working with people, sort of like what I do with Chuck.
So how'd you find this guy? How'd you fall in with this, and what were y'all doing?
He was just a friend of a friend. His name was Mike Fabian, and... We moved to San Francisco, and we were there for 3 months, and then we moved down to L.A., and we're just doing, showcases at the Comedy Store and the Improv.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if we were really in on the ground floor of stand-up comedy.
What year is this?
Probably 76 or something like that.
So, yeah.
And, we were on the ground floor. We got a break and we just fucked up. I mean, because at the Improv, what you do, like at the Comedy Store, you show up on amateur night.
Right.
And if you get a good slot and you kill, then they start telling you, well, you can come back, come back Tuesday at 1 o'clock.
Right.
Then you go anyway. And so we got off of amateur night at the Improv with Bud Friedman, and it was, it was a classic situation. It was, Mike Fabian, did it killed. And Bud Friedman said, where have you been? And it's like, here every Sunday night while you're in the back getting blowjobs for the waitresses, And so we did that for a while. And that was a little hectic. He was a bad alcoholic. We broke up the band of two guys and then got back together, and then he...
Well, the Comedy Store, the Improv in the 70s, I mean, they nurtured big... I mean, Pryor, Letterman, all those guys were there. Did you see any of those people?
Yeah. Oh, we saw... of note, we saw Andy Kaufman.
Yeah, Kaufman.
When he was doing that... When he did that show... As I don't think it was, I don't, was he Tony Clifton?
Yeah,
it was a late night after hours thing. He did a talk show where his seat was like 3 feet higher than
right,
everybody
the
else.
Guess. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, we ran into them, Freddie Prinz,
people like that.
Yeah. And had
Robin Williams was there, I think.
Robin Williams stole one of our jokes, and
really?
He was known.
He's kind
I mean,
of notorious
I know,
for that.
Yeah,
huh?
Yeah. I drew the card to call him up and tell him, and he was a big fan of ours, of Mike's,
okay.
and kind of cooled off after I called him and told him, can you not do our fucking joke?
Also Boozer, Elaine Boozer, wasn't she there?
Elaine Boozler?
Yeah, she was there around this
time. Yeah, a friend of mine, the guy who's house sitting for us in San Francisco, where Kat's sitting while we're gone, my friend Joel, I remember him telling Elaine Boozler she had a nice ass. So,
okay.
Anyway.
All right.
I not that I condone that or
right,
or,
right, right, right.
or you know
well, you
or
could
don't
back then.
Well, man, this is a fascinating story, and we're just scratching the surface here, but looking at the drinks, and Manny, I think it's about that time.
Yeah, well, it's about that time. We take a little break here, and Troubled Nation knows that we'll be right back.
White night, big city. White night. Go.
with Mr. Manny Chevrolet. I am Renee Coleman, back with our guest, Mr. Kurt Lipschutz. Now, Kurt, I know you are new to the podcast, but our listeners are well familiar that this is a listener-supported operation, and we do have a couple of links, a PayPal link and a Venmo link in the show notes of every show, and typically our listeners will support the show, they'll send us a little something, buy some cocktails, pay for some notebooks. Now, it's been a while, Manny. It's been a while since we had the big bag of loose change.
Oh, yeah.
Since we've had someone actually sent an actual, like a 5-pound bag of nickels and pennies, and wound up being about $30. That covered our drinks for one night.
Yeah.
But as you've noticed, listeners, I haven't had to mention anyone's name. That's because we haven't had any support the past few weeks.
Well, people are worried.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody's nervous. Everybody's
nervous.
It's the election.
They might have to leave the country. Well, so they're keeping their change.
People say that. I don't. There's a couple of people that said that about this one. I'm going to hold them to it. You know, if the election doesn't come out the way they want, I'm going to say, well, I expect to see you leaving soon. Anyway, that's it's another story. But anyway, so dig deep, people. If you're still listening to the program,
well, people might have to start. Where I'm from in California, they might have to start doing their own gardening.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Wow.
Uphill gardening.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, we do have those the links in the show notes to support the podcast, and we have a Patreon link there if you want to take the guesswork out of it. Also, we have the link for the Troubled Men podcast T-shirts if you want to give those as gifts. Or
yeah, the holidays are right around
the
corner.
Yeah, don't tarry on that. Also, follow us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, and rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening to us.
Yeah.
Give us 5 stars. Cost you nothing. Helps us a lot.
Amen.
Amen. And you can keep an eye out for Iguana's dates. The link is there in the show notes as well. And that's about enough of that. Back to our guest, the great Mr. Kurt Lipschutz. Now,
wait a minute, hold on. Lipschutz, what kind of name is that?
Lithuanian.
Lithuanian?
Yeah.
Okay. Nice. All right.
But,
I like it. So when last we left you, you were in L.A. Trying your hand at the comedy scene, but your partner has a death wish, or he drinks himself to death. It's very sad. But so how do you get from comedy in L.A. to songwriting with Chuck Prophet in San Francisco?
Well, to jump forward, I went into a coma and woke up in 1989.
Well, no, you wouldn't have to move that fast.
That's when I met. Well, before that, I was writing songs with a guy named Bone Coots, and he had a band called Bone Coots and the Living Wrecks.
And is that in San Francisco?
Yeah, and there was a kind of a seminal club called the Albion.
I remember the Albion,
So that's where Chuck was a co-writer, Green on Red, which
I played with Chuck in Green on Red. He was my roommate.
They had just broken up, and Chuck's first record, I think, was Brother Aldo, which I the only one that I haven't had songs on. And so he saw Bone Coots and Living Wrecks.
Balinese Dancer, was that not the first one?
That was the first one, right, okay, yeah. Right. And so, but he saw Bone Coots, and he liked the songs, and he had Bone and I over to write. We'd written a lot of songs, Bone and I, and to...
How did you fall into that, just...
I saw Bone busking on Hate Street, and I don't know. I mean,
had you been writing songs on your own before
I'd
that?
I'd kind of written a couple of songs with people, but I don't know. I mean, it was just kind of, you know, too much caffeine and starting a conversation, and we chased a record deal back when you actually chased record deals.
Uh-huh.
And
that's with Bone, you mean?
Yeah, with Bone. And Bone and I got together with Chuck and wrote a song, and then Bone dropped out of the songwriting sessions.
Okay.
And this is when Chuck's got an office now. This is when we'd write songs at his apartment, where he's lived at forever.
So what do you mean when Bone dropped out? He just like
of the songwriting sessions. I mean, he just wasn't kind of
He was fucked up.
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe he and Chuck clashed or something.
Brother in Oregon or something.
No,
like
no.
Three people can be hard. Songwriting thing. You know, two is easier than three. I think.
Yeah, I mean, Chuck can be maybe, you know, some might say tyrannical if you're not, if you don't know how to navigate
he's
it.
He's strong-willed. He has his opinions. He's
right, and but you know, so do I. And
sure.
So we wrote four songs together for Balinese Dancer, and then, you know, we've been writing songs together ever since with a. A 10-year break when we weren't speaking, and the official version is that we
had creative differences.
That we were arguing about money that was too much. Okay. You know, sort of a deflection of something that was sordid and not particularly interesting.
Sure,
and then
sure.
we ran into each other on the underground. BART, Bay Area Rapid Transit.
Right.
We 2010, I think, after not speaking for 10 years. And in the interim, I'd had two songs from the catalog on sort of, I'd had songs on every record, but not that many.
Uh-huh.
And he was on the David Letterman show in 2008, and I had two songs on the record, and I didn't watch it because I think he's not going to play my song. And, you know, anyway, he played my song, our song.
Right.
So if he hadn't played the song, You Could Make a Doubter Out of Jesus was the song.
Right, yeah. No,
yeah,
song,
pretty
sure.
Yeah, pretty good episode with Paul Schaefer and everybody.
Yeah.
Anyway, he played our song on David Letterman. And so when we ran into each other, you know, we said,
you had something happy to talk
about. Yeah, 10 years is long enough.
Sure.
You know, yeah, so...
Well, what were you doing besides songwriting with Chuck during all this time? Were you writing poetry?
Yeah, I was writing poetry.
Well, you've written a whole bunch of books too, right?
Well, so, I'm not written, but I mean, I've published a lot of small press books that not so as you'd notice, but something approaching a kind of a low level career. I mean, I'm basically too. You know, intellectual for the street poets and too street for the academics. And, you know, I'm just, they just don't, you know, I mean, Manny, Renee, they don't understand me. You know, my brilliance eludes them.
That's how the Trouble Men podcast is. It's the perfect spot for you. Yeah. But so you had been doing that for the whole time that you were working with Chuck before that, going back to the 90s, were you involved in publishing these volumes?
Well, I started to publish. I mean, when I met you, I think I had very little out. And, you know, I do want to say that in 1987, I went back to New York and was staying... above the maybe the bottom, not the bottom line. I forget where we were staying, above a club where Henry Butler was playing.
Okay.
And there was a kid there who was staying with his girlfriend too. This was somebody's friends. And I was 30 years old, and I, you know, was telling him what I did. I remember this kid telling me that he was going to intern on the Howard Stern show. I didn't know who Howard Stern was.
Uh-huh.
He's going to be retired. And he actually said to me when I said, well, you know, I don't have any books out there. He said, no offense, but if that's all I'd accomplished by your age, I'd kill myself.
And that was Baba Booey from Howard Stern show.
No, it was
Stuttering John.
I didn't take him up on his offer, and then I got a few things published. You know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, are you a musician or just a writer?
Can we get rid of that? Anyway, I'm not a musician, but I kind of feel like I have some input into the songs, kind of.
Well, yeah, I know.
Rhythmically
but...
and stuff. No, I don't. No, I've tried to play guitar, and it's another one of my endless failures is not learning how to play guitar.
It's good to you know, our society has been so successful because we have specialization, you know.
Right.
Not everybody has to do everything well, you know. You just have to do a couple of things well.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Or maybe half a thing well in my case.
Sure. Yeah, there you go.
Well, cuz I was in a band and I just wrote the lyrics, but every once in a while, I would come up with, "Oh, that would be good." Just do, and
right.
I could write lyrics, and that's basically it. Because I don't play any kind of instrument.
Did they change your lyrics, or did they change
the verse forms
or anything?
No. The music was done by the guitar player.
He was a performer.
I just performed it.
But did they write music to your lyrics?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Is there a typical scenario of do you write lyrics ahead of time that you bring in and I
bring stuff in, but we start with musical ideas. I think there's one song we've co-written out of maybe, you know, I think he's recorded about 100 of our co-writes.
Uh-huh.
But one song that the form stayed that I brought in.
Okay.
Chuck just sort of takes it all apart.
Right.
And, you know, he doesn't say this anymore, but he used to. He used to kind of, you know, call the lyrics that I brought in words on paper in a very kind of...
Okay.
You know, in a way that was not a compliment. You know?
Right.
And so, you know, he couldn't chew it around in his mouth and, you know, wasn't, you know. So, things get poured through some kind of an osterizer somehow.
Right.
And, you know.
Well, that's the thing. Once you have a partner that you have a good working relationship with, after a while it's like any muscle that you develop, it gets stronger. And I would imagine the process gets more intuitive over time.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. And I mean, you know, I might be Chuck's biggest fan. I mean, he's very musical.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, he's terrific. You know, and he kind of, you know, knows what he likes. And a lot of times he tells me that something, you know, doesn't scan, and he says it doesn't fit the melody. And I always think he's talking about the rhythm, but I don't know what, but he's got his own, you know, lexicon.
Well, you know, so much about like what a singer feels comfortable with a lot of time is just how the words feel in their mouth. How do they roll out? You know, it's, and the rhythm might not be necessarily the actual rhythm of issue, time-wise, but how do these syllables
right
out,
oh,
know?
Yeah.
And unless you're the guy singing it, it's hard to know whether that's going to work for him or not.
I mean, having written poetry for, you know, 40 years, it kind of hurts sometimes when he lectures me on alliteration, but it's okay. I mean, somehow things, you know, I mean, you know, there's just a magic about being in the room, I guess, right?
Yes.
You know, so... And you know, it's not you know, and sometimes it's kind of like when I'm at home writing, I don't care if I screw around for 4 hours. I mean, the important thing is that I've done something by the end of the day, and that I'm dressed by the time my wife gets home.
Sure.
From work. You know, But with Chuck, you know, I'm dressed in there. I'm dressed with Chuck, though, let me be clear.
Right.
But it, you know, maybe by the end of the day, something happens. You know, sometimes you just sit there looking at your shoes like you're an emo rocker or something.
Yeah.
I don't, you know.
Now, when you're, before you meet with Chuck, or just as your regular writer's practice, do you have a routine where do you write a certain time every day or
no.
try to write every day?
I try and do something by the end of the day.
Okay, when you're just by yourself.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I mean, I wish I was organized. I mean, I've done other things. I've tried to write plays and things like that. And I know people who are very into research. I just can't. I'm not organized like that. I think I got ADD or something.
Right. Okay. Right. Well, that would make sense.
So you never wrote a play or a short story or a novel or?
Well, I have written a play now. It's kind of a disaster. We're rewriting it.
Okay.
And. Which we may not get into, but it, you know, Chuck and I have been working on a musical for about 75 years.
Well, yeah. Okay. So, yeah. So Chuck is very prolific. He's since the first record y'all put out, he's pretty much put out a record every 2 years. And then, you know, you had that gap where he was still putting out records every 2 years, but then you kind of started back after that gap. And one of the records y'all made was Temple Beautiful.
Yeah, that was the first one, and that's the only one that I co-wrote all the songs on.
Okay.
And that's the one that we're, you know.
So that's that. Talk about that record. It's kind of a tribute to San Francisco.
It's a tribute to San Francisco. I mean, it's not really a song cycle. Afterwards, you know, that when the record came out, people said, "Well, where's the song about the persecution of, you know, the Asian population?" You know, like, so we didn't cover all the bases like that. And it's like, we one obscure character, a historical character, a eccentric in San Francisco in the 1860s named Emperor Norton, who called himself Emperor of the United States and Protector of Mexico. He became kind of the guiding light for the musical that we've been writing. So
that's something y'all, you actually, and in preparation for this, you were said you're asked me about Chris Lane, if I knew Chris Lane.
Yeah.
And Chris Lane, actor that we had on the podcast
in July.
And turns out I didn't come up in the thing with Chris, but Chris had gone out there and he was part of
the
guy who's dressed as the boy who cried wolf. Remember?
Oh, that guy.
Our the director for our musical for 6 or 7 years, Emily Whalen, who used to live here and was associated with Cripple Creek Theater or something.
Okay.
And she brought Chris Lane out for a staged reading that we did.
Uh-huh.
You know. So yeah. And he Chris was great. I mean, he's
a fun guy.
Yeah.
Some good Chris Lane stories. Well, crazy. So this is something that's been in development, trying to get it staged. Broadway.
That would be nice to get to, you know, off Broadway would
right,
be nice
right,
too.
Right.
But yeah, we got some current schemes. I mean, we've been working on it really for 14 years, three producers, people, you know, $60,000. Invested in it about $10 went into Chuck's pocket and $10 went into mine,
right?
You know, okay. But that's going on. But maybe I should talk about his new record because he's got
a
new record.
Absolutely.
Week.
Yes. Know? Talk about the, yes. Terrific record. Wake the Dead came out as a Chuck with, Kina Save.
Yes.
It's a like a band doing a lot of it's a kind of a cumbia band to begin with, I guess, while Chuck was recovering from his brush with death,
his lymphoma. Yeah, and I mean, because the Iguanas are a dance band in a lot of ways, right?
We have always been a dance band. I mean, we've been playing, and you know, we play Mexican music and you know, New Orleans R&B, and we've been playing cumbias since the early 90s. I mean, that the band was formed with that as part of our foundational thing. So we've always done that material as part of our repertoire and written in those styles. Now, that's something that has a form that's become more popular in the zeitgeist in the last couple of years.
Well, Chuck was saying, you know, he'd go to these, you know, he'd go to kind of Americana or Genericana bands, and there'd be, you know, like 15 people there, and then he'd go to a cumbia show where there's 400 people dancing.
Oh, right.
And, yeah, you know, the pandemic happened, Chuck got lymphoma. He just immersed himself in cumbia music and wanted to do something different.
Right.
And he's, I mean, and again, you know, there's a lot of purists and a lot of, you know, people talk about, you know, I don't know, there might be some rumbles about cultural appropriation.
Ah, yeah.
I mean, Chuck, you know, he said, what Chuck's answer to that is, like, sir, put down that burrito.
Yeah, right.
You can't eat that burrito, you know, unless you made the tortillas yourself or something.
He made
this thing happen, and the record, he's getting ready to tour Europe, and with the band, he's actually taken for the first time a six-person, six-man band
right
with him. Which I think might mean that Chuck doesn't get paid,
Well, because, it's
not that money is kind of a, maybe we don't talk about that, but it is a six-man band because Stephanie Finch's wife is not in this. She's still in the Mission Express,
right?
But she's not in this band.
Okay.
So, is she
going to be traveling with the band?
No.
Okay, she's going to let Chuck out there.
She is letting Chuck out there. I don't know if she's going to let him come home. I wouldn't want to be privy to the conversations that the bedroom talk. Am I in the band? But I've written songs with Stephanie too. Stephanie has made a couple of really cool albums.
Yeah, yeah. Your Go-Go Market project. I saw you had some co-writes with her on that. That was a very cool project.
Yeah, yeah.
But Stephanie's lovely, isn't she?
Yeah. I know my ADD is dragging you guys just every direction.
No, we like that.
What can I say about? I love the record. I'm trying to think of I probably about six or seven of the songs are hardcore, not hardcore, would be cumbia. I mean,
right.
You might listen to it and say, okay. But Chuck has dug deep and he wanted to get players who were native to the form.
Yeah, no,
and
so sounds
he ended.
Terrific,
I mean, his rap.
What is cumbia? I don't know.
Well,
what that
I'm gonna let Renee.
Well, it's a style of Mexican dance music.
But I think it started in Peru. I mean, it's
yes, he's correct. It's Peru, Colombia is primarily.
It's like oompa music.
No, it's not polka. It's it has a certain rhythm to it, but it's a dance music.
On a blind taste test, I might not be able to tell a cumbia song from Tex-Mex or something like that.
Flaco Jimenez played cumbias, the Texas Tornadoes would play cumbias. That's part of, Los Lobos would play cumbias. It's a form within the...
Right. He wanted to get people on their feet. He wanted to do something different. He had a very hard time, with lymphoma. I mean, they thought he might, for 2 weeks they didn't know whether, my brother had lymphoma. There's kinds that are treatable and there's kinds that aren't, and you sweat out while they're doing the test. Chuck's was treatable and he had a very good result,
but he had a full recovery, right? I mean,
he had a very bad 6 to 8 months. And we wrote songs during all that time, and of course during the pandemic. So then there's 4 years between the last album and this one, which is.
It's a long time for that reason.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So.
But man, it's a terrific record, and it's
yeah.
Great
we're
to see.
We're pretty jazzed, and I just sit back. I mean, I'm pretty stupid. I check in and see how many hits are on YouTube. I mean, it's
okay.
Very. I mean, I have poor impulse control in general.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it's not something like, what's the difference?
Well, I know Chuck. I saw his schedule, the touring schedule. He's hitting it hard. He's going out in November, all through Europe, and then he's doing England after that. And then he's actually coming to New Orleans too, and in what, February, I think he has a Chickiwawa date, and he'll be here. So
yeah, he was telling me just today that his feet were going to be cold for a whole month.
Yeah,
you know, yeah, you know.
Yeah, he's a hard worker, man.
Yeah, he's getting a little old for that, but that's the name of the game.
Yeah, it keeps you young, man.
Yeah,
activity. Well, so maybe we'll get Chuck on the podcast when he comes back in February, because we had him on during the pandemic, like remotely.
Right. Okay.
It's so much more fun like this, where you see everybody's facial expressions.
This is
Didn't he live near the apartment where Shut Up, Little Man?
Yeah.
He lived by those people.
I think he did, yeah.
That pink apartment was like a Pepto-Bismol looking apartment.
I didn't know where the apartment was, but I loved that.
But he lived in that neighborhood.
That sounds right.
Yeah.
Best thing this side of the Jerky Boys,
they were fabulous. Yeah. But let me ask you, you're a poet. Besides the word, besides Venus, what other word rhymes with penis?
You know, if you're Eminem,
Kleenex.
If you're Eminem genius,
okay.
There you go. Yeah,
rhymes and the
those
near
guys
rhymes.
Can make a lot of things happen.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
That's the
Now, what do you think about haiku poetry?
It's pretty hard to distinguish yourself in that form, and that's why it lends itself to jokes. There's like a joke book about golf haiku and this and that.
Yeah.
But and part of it is the slavishness of the 5-7-5, right, getting the three lines is, in English, a lot of stuff. Well, like some of the best haikus in English don't conform to that. Therefore, our Jack Kerouac's Mexico City Blues.
Okay.
You know, so haiku, can be great, but there is a side of it that it's hard to get past a fortune cookie level, really.
You know? Right. Yeah. Because I never really got poetry. I don't understand it.
Oh, okay. Well.
You know, I don't get it.
Okay. You're in a lot of company.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I wish I had Jim Morrison here to explain it to you.
Listen
to him.
Well, we should try to get him.
You'd listen to the Lizard King, goddammit.
Yeah.
Well, so you're still writing non-lyric work. You're still doing.
I'm doing stuff. I'm working on a play, and I actually get a big kick out of the literary editing too. I really throw myself into.
Yeah, you have some clients who are publishing books and are working on it.
Yeah, I have a client. He's in Gulfport, Mississippi, who is coming in to take us out to Antoine's on Sunday
Antoine's
for lunch.
Oh, Antoine's terrific. Man.
Yeah,
oh,
and
man.
He's and the client in Gulfport is Jewish, and his family was in the junkyard business, and they were prosecuted in the 1990s under the RICO statutes by...
In Mississippi?
Yeah, by Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, who was the...
Jeff Sessions.
Who was the U.S. attorney for the District of Alabama.
Oh.
My client was facing 30 years in jail.
Oh, my God.
And they got off, all white jury. I mean, not all white, but all Christian jury.
Uh-huh.
And kind of a harrowing story.
He wrote a
memoir, and then he got to me and turned it into a novel. And then after it was done, changed it from the third person to the first person.
Okay.
And so it's called The Junk Man. And it's pretty terrific. And notable things about it, I don't know if anything is unique, is it's written from the defendant's point of view.
Right.
The guy whose ass is on the line, basically, right? You know, while he's being slow pressure cook. Like,
right. Well,
like the frogs or whoever.
Sure, sure.
Are.
Well, yeah. Gulfport's a whole scene, man. That whole Gulf Coast mafia. I mean, that really, it's the jurisdiction of the New Orleans mob all the way out there. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No,
well, I mean, he's got a whole, you know, his family is from Meridian and, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I don't, you know, they... I came from Russia, you know.
Right,
but,
right.
But anyway, but I'm I've been trying to help him get that published, and you know, it in the current climate, and maybe it's not a good time to be a Jewish writer, you know.
You never know. It's hard to tell what's right around the corner. We didn't see this coming, did we?
Yeah.
So great to have you here. We're kind of winding down in the podcast, and glad you were able to...
Give him a sticker.
Yeah, yeah, we have stickers for you here.
Okay.
There's a couple of Trouble Men podcast stickers. I can give you a couple more if you have... but you don't have a lot of computers or,
I do.
Or guitar cases. Okay.
Well, I do have a computer. And okay. I forgot them, but I'm going to inflict some of my books on you guys. Through the U.S.
Right.
mail.
Nice.
All right. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Kurt. And,
you've been fabulous.
You've been fabulous, absolutely. And as always on the Troubled Men podcast, we like to say, trouble never ends.
But the struggle continues. Good night.
Good night.
Go and wake the dead. Get them on their feet. Gonna count our nickels like we're counting sheep. Gonna rob from Peter. Hey, Paul, and that's not all. Gonna teach the children a little history, but not too much now. Gonna cop a plea. Gonna rob from Peter to pay Paul, and that's not all. We might have ourselves a picnic. We might end up on the moon. They might even name a planet after me. If they ask you any questions, go ahead and tell the truth. If we have to, we can plead insanity. If it's good enough for you, it works for me. Wake the dead, get them on their feet. Gonna form an army, gonna plant a tree. Gonna rob from Peter to pay Paul. Yeah, that's not all. We might have ourselves a picnic. We might end up on the moon. They might even make a model out of me. Ask you any questions, go ahead and tell the truth. If we have to, we can plead insanity. If it's good enough for you, it works for me. If it's good enough for you, it works for me.